You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the rights to digital images called non-fungible tokens are selling for tens of thousands of bucks and more. We'll learn what an NFT is and why people buy them. First, shoveling the driveway and sidewalk may not be your favorite winter activity, being out in the cold, lifting heavy loads of snow, and it takes a while. Our next guest isn't a big fan either for a different reason. He says it's particularly dangerous, can even be deadly. In fact, he knows two people who have died either during or after snow removal. If you're 45 or older, he says maybe you shouldn't even do it. But if you insist, take some basic precautions to protect your health. Dr. Barry Franklin is Director of Preventive Cardiology and Cardiac Rehabilitation at Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan, also Professor of Physiology at Wayne State University's School of Medicine and Professor of Internal Medicine at Oakland University. He's written more than two dozen books, including the forthcoming GPS for Success, Behavioral Skills, Strategies, and Secrets of Superachievers. Dr. Franklin, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, it's a common household chore in your state and mine. Why can shoveling be dangerous?
Well, you know, I remember picking up the Detroit Free Press in 1992, and I read the following headline: in Wayne County alone, 17 heart attack deaths were attributed to exertion since the snow began Tuesday. Most of the victims were older men clearing their walks and driveways of snow. I lost two dear friends to this activity, as you alluded to, and research tells us that we lose between 1,000 and 1,500 people each year due to snow shoveling deaths. So it's a dangerous activity.
It doesn't seem like it should be that hard, but yeah, my heart rate gets up when I shovel. There are studies comparing it to rigorous exercise. What do we find out?
Rob, we did some studies at Beaumont. We took 10 healthy guys under the age of 35. We did a maximal treadmill test on those individuals. Then on a different day, the same time of day, we had them shovel heavy, wet snow. We were astounded by the results. Heart rate and blood pressure of those subjects while they were shoveling snow skyrocketed to levels that were achieved or even greater than maximal treadmill testing. We also measured energy expenditure during snow shoveling. It was what we call six METs, or six metabolic equivalents. That's equivalent to playing singles tennis. What 60 or 70 year old would go out and would normally play singles tennis? Most importantly, we measured 10 minutes of shoveling heavy, wet snow in these guys, and the average guy in 10 minutes moved 1,920 pounds. That's almost a ton of snow. That's the weight of a mid-size automobile. So it's an extremely taxing activity.
Are there any other things about shoveling in particular that might raise the heart risk?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Five factors, I think, that contribute to it. Number one, it involves arm exercise. Arm exercise is more taxing than leg exercise. You get a higher heart rate and blood pressure response. Secondly, you're working in an upright position, but you're not walking on a treadmill. You're largely standing still, so the legs are motionless. Blood tends to pool in the lower extremities. It involves static or isometric exertion, which increases the heart rate and blood pressure. It involves breath holding or straining. And lastly, you're exposed to dangerous cold air and wind chill factors. All these factors, Rob, have a big increase in heart rate and blood pressure, while simultaneously the cold air is constricting the coronary arteries, feeding the heart muscle. As George Clooney would say, it's a perfect storm.
Talking to Dr. Barry Franklin, cardiologist at Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan, talking about the hazards of snow shoveling. Dr. Franklin, who out there listening right now should be a non-starter, like hire that neighborhood kid, whatever, just don't shovel? Who would you have that kind of absolute message for?
Well, I would highlight the fact that a major U.S. study several years ago estimated that about 85% of all U.S. adults over the age of 50 already have underlying atherosclerotic heart disease or clogged coronary arteries. So I tell people, if they're over the age of 45, if they got a history of angioplasty, bypass surgery, if they have symptoms suggestive of heart disease called angina, or if they got high cholesterol, high blood pressure, they're a cigarette smoker, these are people who are at high risk for exercise related sudden cardiac death during snow shoveling. So I say to those people, hire a plow or hire the neighborhood kid to do it for you.
Now, for people who aren't quite in that category, but, you know, are over 45, but still want to do it themselves, do you have some advice to make it safer than it could be otherwise?
Excellent question. Number one, snowblowers do reduce the demands. Our studies at Beaumont showed heart rates are about 60 beats higher while you're moving snow while you're when shoveling versus using a snowblower. If you're shoveling, if you can push the snow rather than lifting and throwing, you're better off. Dress appropriately in layers. Use a hat, gloves, scarves. If you can, put a scarf over the mouth so you're not breathing that cold air in. Avoid heavy meals, smoking, high caffeine, alcohol consumption before shoveling. Pace yourself. Adopt a work-rest approach. Don't ignore symptoms. I tell patients if you got pain or discomfort from your belly button on up that comes on when you're exerting yourself, shoveling snow, stop and beware of cold and windy conditions. I tell every one of our patients to paste a little label on your shovel that reads, warning, use of this instrument for snow removal may be hazardous to your health.
And maybe this is a case for when we're not shoveling, just to safely, maybe consulting with our doctor if we have worries, up our exercise game a little better so we're ready for any kind of exertion.
Yeah, you're exactly right. People who often have the problems are people who are morbidly obese, habitually sedentary, or physically inactive. So by participating in a regular exercise program, you reduce the likelihood of running into problems if you have to remove snow.
And can you remind us, before I let you go, Dr. Franklin, what are the warning signs we should be watching for when we're shoveling or any time when it comes to some kind of bad cardiac event?
Yeah. With underlying heart disease, I tell patients, if you have pain or discomfort anywhere from your belly button on up that comes on with exertion, that could be a sign of insufficient blood and oxygen flow to your heart muscle, extreme shortness of breath, irregular heart rhythm. Those are all major factors that suggest there's a potential problem. And those are people who should not be shoveling heavy, wet snow.
Dr. Franklin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, pleasure chatting with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's Dr. Barry Franklin, Director of Preventive Cardiology and Cardiac Rehabilitation at Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan. He joined us today to talk about how to shovel safely in our driveways and sidewalks and why he says people older than 45 may want to find another way to get the job done. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about dogs and the snow.
Dog sledding has been a family affair for writer Julie Buckles. She and her husband, Charlie Ray, caught the bug when they first moved to northern Wisconsin. In the past, she raced with her daughter, Caroline, in the annual Apostle Islands dog sled race. The mother of two considered hanging it up, but she just kept on dogging it. Danielle Kading brings us this audio postcard.
If you have dogs that are kind of snippy or have a bad attitude, it just takes all the fun out of it. So actually, everyone in this kennel has a great attitude. When we moved up here, we were introduced to the racing community through the first Apostle Island sled dog race. And we also had met John and Mary Thiel, who run Wolfsong Mushing. They do it as a business. And they had taken, it was back when they had four dogs, they have 50 now. But when they had four dogs, they took us out and we just thought that was super fun. And Charlie and I had done some big wilderness trips and Charlie had this idea that if we had dogs, we could go out and do winter wilderness trips. And so for my birthday one year, he built me a dog box and said we were gonna go fill it. I always thought dog sledding would end when my kids weren't interested anymore. And so Caroline had raced four races and she had been so involved with the dogs, but she was 13 and she's got sports. She's in cross country ski team. And she basically said, I'm done. Charlie and I agreed we were going to start selling, and he even started selling gear on Craigslist. And he came to me to talk to me about what we should price it at. And I started to cry. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to be done. A month or two later, Blair, who has a racing kennel, called me and said, I have this awesome dog named Popeye who just has a heart murmur and so he can't do longer races. Are you interested? And I don't know, just that name Popeye, I was sucked in. Every musher has a story about how it started with one dog. Kind of my rebirth in dog sledding started with one dog, and it's Popeye. And he's the loudest one in the kennel. I usually get them out four times a week minimum. They really need to be exercised at least every other day. This is their prime time. It's cold. They're ready to go. They're part of our family because with this team, I almost never ever give dogs away. Once they're here for life. I reached a point one year where we had a set of dogs that all died, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't say goodbye to any more dogs. But then a new dog comes along and you fall in love again. And you just realize that that's part of the deal. Unbite, unbite, unbite. All right, hi, hi. It's really an awesome time because I think about one thing, and it's the dogs. Because dog sledding is a 0-50 sport. You could be trotting along 1 minute, and if you stop paying attention, you've gone to 50, and you've got a tangle, your team is loose. It's all consuming. And so when you're out, this is all you're thinking about. But then every once in a while, my mind does wander, and I think about things like, which dogs will get to run at the sled dog race? And I think it's these six. And then, or I might think about, like, if I had a new litter of sled dog pups, what theme would I choose to name them all? And it's just everything about these guys is so, so much fun. And just being out there with them is just, it's all about them. I don't think about bills or emails or what I have to do next. I just think about that run, that day, and how well it's going. And when it goes well, it's a really great day. Right, guys?
Danielle Kading is a reporter with the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, learn about non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, what they are, and why people are spending lots of money on them. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The market for digital images took off last year with the rise of what are called non-fungible tokens, or NFTs for short. Celebrities, corporations, even politicians are getting in on the NFT boom, and especially artists, with sales reaching just under $25 billion in 2021. But not many of us, including me, really understand what they are, how they work, or why people buy them. Josh White is an assistant professor of finance at Vanderbilt University. He was previously a financial economist for the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Give me it in a sense that a radio host can understand, what is a non-fungible token?
Yeah, that's the billion-dollar question right now.
So, literally.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So let's start with fungible versus non-fungible. So a fungible asset. That's something you can exchange pretty easily. So if I gave you a $20 bill, you could give me two $10 bills and they would have the same value. So it's pretty fungible. So in the crypto space, you know, Bitcoin is actually fungible. It's a fungible token. If I give you one Bitcoin, you can give me one Bitcoin back and we have the same thing. But for a non-fungible asset, that has to be unique and non-divisible. So, you know, your car that you drove to work today, your house, those are very unique assets. They're one of a kind. So a non-fungible token is a way to represent sort of any unique asset and do so on the blockchain.
And the blockchain is what kind of guarantees its uniqueness, I guess. What are some of the range of things we've seen turned into these sellable but non-replicatable, I guess, NFTs?
Yeah. So it's exactly that. You know, most of these are based on Ethereum, which is a blockchain technology that gave us the Ethereum or Ether cryptocurrency. So a lot of the early rage with NFTs came from digital art. You know, if you own the Mona Lisa, we know that has an intrinsic value and that's pretty easy. But if you're a digital artist, then your files or your art can be sort of easily and endlessly duplicated. And so with an NFT, the reason it took off is because you can tokenize that art and it allows the, you know, the content creator to monetize that. And I can give you a digital certificate of ownership and it's unique and that ownership can be verified.
So say I become an artist, not going to happen, but say I do, and I paint Mona Lisa 2022 by Rob. I can send all sorts of images. People can copy them, but I can declare one to be the unique one, give it this Ethereum blockchain code that makes it unique. I've just created an NFT. Did I do it right?
You did it right. You got that right. And I don't know what the value would be. I haven't seen your art.
Oh, it's very, very low.
You know, where this took off to sort of in the early stage is in collectibles. So it moved from art to collectibles. There's something called NBA Top Shot, where when I was a kid, I would collect baseball cards. But these are collections of digital highlights, and you can trade the digital highlights with other people that collect them. And so these NFTs allowed sort of a community to build around collecting digital, you know, content.
So for my Mona Lisa 2022, you know, anybody can have this image, but somebody puts value in having the unique image of that. And that's what gives it value if people are willing to pay for it. That's what's going on with any of these NFTs, right?
Yeah, so the scarcity gives it some value. And, you know, NFTs also can provide content access. And so using the same blockchain technology, you can control who has access to certain content. So if you had some content that you put somewhere on a website, you could have a certain number of NFTs that you sell, and only those that held that would be able to access that content.
Talking to Josh White, assistant professor of finance at Vanderbilt University, looking at these non-fungible tokens, these NFTs, a lot of money in them last year, and we're figuring out what they are, how they work. Now, here's a twist. Some congressional candidates in both parties, even Melania Trump, have sold NFTs for fundraising purposes. This people said this could raise weird questions when it comes to campaign finance and the transparency of who's getting money from whom. What do you think of the political frontiers of this?
Yeah, so we're not too surprised to see it start to spill over in the political space, and some companies are starting to issue these as well. I mean, we know that campaigning is expensive, so they're always looking for sort of unique ways to raise capital to finance that. Some of the questions that come up are exactly what you touched on. You know, we want to make sure we have election commissions that limit the amount of money that, you know, anyone can donate to a campaign. And so, you know, your candidates would not want to run afoul of those sort of campaign finance laws. So the big concern is how they're paying to acquire the NFT. Are they paying with what we call fiat currency, with dollar bills, or are they paying with cryptocurrency? And if it's a cryptocurrency payment, then there's a potential that you can obfuscate who's actually making the donation.
I've seen some people point toward a benefit of selling these tokens, especially in the art world, where an artist can make money, which can be tough to do if you're creating digital art in particular, knowing that once it's out there, anybody can copy it. Do you see that as an upside here?
I do see it as an upside, you know, and we've even seen larger companies start to do this. AP, the Associated Press, they have a large stock of photos, and they're starting to sell, you know, a picture of planet Earth that maybe AP has the rights to. And so I think you will see this across the spectrum of artists and companies and entities looking for a way to monetize some of the assets that they have.
I've seen some people argue, Josh, that this is kind of a wave of the future cutting-edge technology, but there seems to be suspicion out there that this is just some sort of elaborate consensual hallucination that's going to come crashing down someday. Where are you on that spectrum?
Yeah, it's, you know, the last 12 months, it's been very difficult to predict things. We had meme stocks, and we had a wave of this, and we saw the stock market do things that looked pretty irrational. I think the NFT technology and, you know, what it's going to do and how it's going to transform business, I think this might be the lasting technology that comes out of this sort of crypto craze that's actually really useful. And so we're seeing a lot of companies talk about something known as the metaverse. And I think NFTs will be very important there, you know, as you access and monetize content in this space.
If somebody's out there listening thinking, hey, this sounds kind of cool, I'd love to buy something like a digital baseball card or a artist series or something like that, I would not know how to start. How would somebody get into the game here?
Yeah, I would first say I worked at the SEC, so first be careful. You know, a lot of times when we have new technologies, we fall victim to something known as the fear of missing out. And so we enter into something we're not familiar with, and, you know, there's usually somebody on the other side looking to take some money. But I would look at a platform like OpenSea. It's the sort of largest marketplace for trading crypto collectibles. If nothing else, it's fun to see what's being sold, what the values are, who's paying these enormous amount of monies for NFTs. And then also, if it's collectibles, you could think about something like NBA Top Shop, and you could go look at those basketball highlights and see who's paying what for a LeBron James slam dunk. And so those are two places I would start.
Now, I'm not going to ask you for personalized financial advice, but I know some people are using these as vehicles for investment or maybe speculation, if you call it that. What kind of cautions would you have for somebody who thinks of, hey, I'm going to get into this and make lots of money buying and selling these things?
Yeah, so my advice would be, I think it's fine to, so when we think about finance, and so we teach this in our class, we're really not trying to maximize wealth. We're trying to maximize our happiness or utility. And unfortunately, things are expensive. And so usually happiness follows with wealth because we need money to buy things. So I think it's okay to go out and invest and dabble in something like this with small amounts. You know, if it's making you happy and you view it as entertainment and you lose small amounts of money, I think that's okay. If you take your retirement savings and you put a really large amount of money in this space, then that's when it starts to get troublesome.
As we wrap up, Josh, you said you're a baseball card guy. I was too for a while. Is there something you could see yourself dabbling in similar to your old baseball card hobby?
I have bought some of the highlights on this NBA Top Shot. And it's interesting. I think that, when we were kids, it was always the scarce card that brought the, that's the one everybody wanted, the rare Mickey Mantle or whatever. And it's interesting to see that it's the same thing in this space. You see the highlights that there's fewer of those available. They bring more money, and as the players start to do better, the value of those highlights increase. So that's kind of fun to watch.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Josh White is an assistant professor of finance at Vanderbilt University with us to explain non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, and their increasing popularity. I wonder if there's one of the Kurt Bevacqua Major League Baseball bubblegum championship card. That was a favorite of mine as a kid. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll answer a Wisconsin listener question about Wisconsin Dells and how it became one of the top tourist destinations in the Midwest. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then President Biden renewed calls to expand voting rights in a speech in Atlanta yesterday. We'll find out where those efforts stand, some of the roadblocks, and the response the speech is getting from Republicans. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, are you confused about at-home COVID testing? If so, you are not alone. We're going to do a rapid test 101 with a scientist who's been following the latest technology. First, President Joe Biden was in Atlanta yesterday making the case for a Democratic effort to expand voting rights.
I will not yield. I will not flinch. I will defend the right to vote, our democracy against all enemies, foreign and, yes, domestic.
After the speech, though, some voting rights advocates say the president isn't doing enough to prioritize the issue. Republicans, on the other hand, say the changes in Congress would go too far. It's the week in Washington. We'll look at that story and more, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of the voting and election reforms you would support? Should we make Election Day a federal holiday? Do you want to see a minimum amount of time required for all states to allow early voting? How about those drop boxes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
We heard a little taste of Biden's speech there. Can you tell us a little more what we heard from the president and what stood out to you?
Yeah, the president really leaned hard into his push to try to get Congress to pass a voting bill. To be clear, this is still very unlikely to happen, but we saw Biden give another really strong and resounding endorsement of some action by Congress. The House has passed a number of bills. It's the Senate where things are held up, and particularly because the Senate generally requires 60 votes to pass almost all legislation. Biden also went a step further in his speech on Tuesday and endorsed the Senate abandoning the filibuster, at least for this piece of legislation. And the filibuster, as most of your listeners probably know, is that 60-vote threshold. But to be clear, Democrats don't have the votes to do that either. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Kristen Sinema of Arizona have both said that they won't support changing the rules with just 50 Democrats. So it looks like this is still going to be an effort that is a real uphill battle. And unless Democrats start talking about paring the bills back and finding some compromise with Republicans, it's unlikely that it'll get passed.
Can you remind us of the two main bills on the table that are kind of at the center of all of this?
Yes. So there's two big pieces of legislation that the Senate is still sort of weighing. The first is called the Freedom to Vote Act. And this was a bill that was a pared down version of another bill that passed the House. This was negotiated by Democrats among Democrats to get the support of Senator Joe Manchin. It still does a lot of things in this piece of legislation. It would create lots of national standards, sort of baseline standards, things like the number of early voting days, the ability to register to vote on election day or online or at the DMV, redistricting. It would change some campaign finance laws. It's got a whole lot of stuff in there. Some things that are pretty responsive to bills we saw Republicans pass in the last year, and some things that Democrats have been pushing for a long time. The other piece of legislation is called the John Lewis Voting Act. And this is a much more narrower piece of legislation. It would address a change that was made to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that sort of landmark legislation that prevented discrimination. The Supreme Court several years ago struck down a portion of that law. In a decision known as Shelby County versus Holder, and a portion of that law known as preclearance, which basically said, if you are a state with a track record of passing discriminatory laws, to change your election laws, you had to get approval from the Department of Justice. The Supreme Court said that the way that those states were selected was not constitutional, and they struck down that part of the law. This new law would create a new system to determine which states are subject to approval from the Department of Justice. And it's probably about 10 states if this was to be enacted, that would be, or 15 states that would be subject to these rules.
I want to listen to some of the response to President Biden's speech. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor earlier today.
1 week ago, President Biden gave a January 6th lecture about not stoking political violence. 1 week ago. Yesterday, with the world's largest megaphone, he invoked the literal civil war and said we are on the doorstep of autocracy. Talked about domestic enemies. Rhetoric unbecoming of a president of the United States.
So first of all, what do you think of Senate Minority Leader McConnell's talk about the rhetoric there being overheated?
Yeah, there's a lot of heated rhetoric here. And I think that there's a few things going on. We've heard Senator McConnell increase sort of the volume on his criticism of Democrats discussing changing the filibuster rules over the last few weeks. He's become increasingly critical and really sort of turned up the heat on what he thinks is the wrong move for them to do. His criticism of Biden, I think it's important to remember that while Democrats have painted this voting bill that they've been trying to pass as sort of good for democracy and good for all, Republicans have a lot of longstanding grievances with some elements of this legislation. They fundamentally disagree on how to change the campaign finance system, for example. Republicans think there should be less limits and more disclosure. Democrats think there should be more limits and more disclosure. But I think that what we're seeing here is a very partisan bill. It has not gone through any level of scrutiny that would make it, or negotiations that would make it in the least bit bipartisan. This is something that Democrats want and Republicans have not wanted for a long time. And so Biden was talking about a partisan piece of legislation. And I think we heard a very partisan response from Mitch McConnell.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from NBC News Digital, looking at some of the top stories in national politics right now, looking at efforts by Democrats to pass their voting rights bills. Big speech by the president yesterday making the case for them. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that. Let's bring on a caller now. James is with us on the road. James, hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, James?
I wanted to bring up that I heard on radio the other day where a few years ago they wanted Mitch McConnell talked about ending the filibuster, and Chuck Schumer was completely against it then. And now he's all for it.
James, thanks for the call. And the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, has effectively, I think James is about right there, has changed his position when it comes to this voting rights bill, when it comes to the filibuster, Ginger.
And I mean, I think that's part of what Joe Manchin's argument here is in favor of the filibuster. Democrats, it wasn't that long ago. It was 2017. It was just 4 years ago that Republicans held the majority in the House and the Senate and the White House. And Democrats relied heavily upon that 60 vote threshold to block legislation that otherwise President Trump would have signed into law. And Manchin makes the argument that if they were to change the rules now for Democrats, it's not like Republicans are going to say, well, next time we're in control, we'll go back to the rules we had before. No, they're going to do the same thing that Democrats are doing now. And that's part of the argument here. And I think it's also important to remember that while Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are very vocal in their opposition to changing the filibuster rules, they're not alone. We know that there are several lawmakers in the Senate, Democrats, who think that the same concerns, that they would be giving Republicans power, much more power than they would have otherwise in a few years, possibly in as little as 3 years, and that they're concerned about that. They're just not being as vocal about their concerns as their colleagues are.
James, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ginger, we focused so far on the response from Republicans. There are some voting rights advocates who want to see these bills passed who are critical of President Biden for, they say, not doing enough. What kind of things are we hearing?
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of frustration among voting rights advocates, among those who are really lobbying strongly for this legislation, that they feel that President Biden just hasn't done enough to get this legislation across the finish line. They argue that had Biden made this his number one priority when he took office, had he put all of his political capital into this instead of the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better bill, which still hasn't passed, that they might have been more capable of getting something done, that instead he focused on these spending bills. And then because of that, because he didn't put all of his political capital into this voting bill, he didn't do enough. I mean, this is a really complicated dynamic. I mean, it's possible that the president could have made this his number one priority, talked about it every day since he took office, and still it wouldn't have passed because there's just fundamental disagreement in the Senate over it. So it's a difficult road for the president to have to navigate. And I think we're really seeing that in the criticism that he's facing from within his own party, that they feel like he hasn't done enough, but there may just not be anything more that he could do.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, with us today to look at some of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The push for voting rights changes, too much, not enough. What do you think? 800-642-1234. And coming up, efforts to get more COVID tests out, especially to schools. Are you a caregiver who's struggled to find a test for your child? If you work at a school, what does the need for testing look like from your perspective? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Ginger Gibson is our guest from NBC News Digital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on the efforts to pass new voting laws in Congress, or on the effort by the federal government to get COVID tests out, especially to schools. And coming up, we'll talk about the latest contacts between U.S. and Russia trying to dial things down around Ukraine. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger, what are we hearing as far as details on this plan from the Biden administration aimed at getting these COVID-19 tests to schools around the country?
That's right. The president has really struggled with testing during this latest surge in COVID. They came out in December and really argued that they were going to tests to stay, that schools were going to stay open by increasing the amount of testing. And even if a kid had been exposed, they tested negative, they could stay in school. But the problem became no one could get a test, and so you couldn't really test to stay. And so the White House has now said that they're going to ship millions, 10 million a month to schools to help them implement these testing programs. That's a lot of tests. And we're really seeing a logistical challenge in its infancy for the White House. I think they're talking about millions of tests mailed to people, individual people at their homes, in addition to now millions of tests going out to schools. And so they're contracting, they're trying to find people to send these tests out, but whether they get them out in a way that is able to have them utilized and make a difference is still to be determined.
Right. And there's about 950,000 K-12 students in Wisconsin alone. 10 million sounds like a big number, but there's lots of kids, lots of staff and teachers for that matter. Is there a view that this number is going to be enough, even assuming they can get them out there?
I mean, I think that's one of the big questions. How many tests do you need, especially if you're regularly or routinely testing? There are some districts in the country that have set up regular testing regimens, some in Georgia and the Atlanta area, where they're testing students, all the students, twice a week. And those schools have had to acquire millions of tests on their own to be able to do this. So it's a real challenge for these districts to try to find a way to implement this. And I think we're going to continue to see questions about, is it enough tests? Are they getting there quickly enough? Do the tests work adequately? There's been a lot of questions about whether these rapid tests are catching the Omicron variant quickly enough. And I think those questions are still going to be lingering for the coming weeks, unless by some magic, COVID sort of slinks away on us here in the coming months.
In our next conversation, by the way, today we're going to talk about some of the science and the practical advice when it comes to these rapid tests. Ginger, this is the week in Washington, so let's talk about some of the politics here. Biden administration getting criticism for not being ready for this surge in demand for tests after a year in office. Some polling showing, I think for the first time, disapproval of the Biden administration's handling of COVID in particular, seeing less support than disapproval at this point. How big a political issue is this getting to be for the White House?
This is a very big political issue for the White House. The president's approval in a Quinnipiac poll that came out today was 33%. And that's pretty abysmal. That basically means only your real strident partisans are approving of your job. And part of those numbers, too, was a real indictment of how the handling of COVID at this point. People are less forgiving. They feel like we've been at this for a while, that he's been at this for a year, that they should be figuring it out. And the logistical struggles that are facing Americans, the inability to get a test, the inability to send their kids to school, I think that's really weighing on people. Politically, the White House is looking at November of this year, when midterms happen, when states are going to be considering who to send to Congress, when Wisconsin's going to be considering whether to return Ron Johnson to the Senate. And I think that there's a lot of concern among Democrats, and maybe a little bit in the White House, even if they won't admit it, that these numbers are really going to weigh on them when they get to Election Day in November. People remember if they had two miserable weeks at home with their kids because they couldn't get a test to figure out if they could go back to school. And those are the things that inform people's decisions when they show up on Election Day.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, checking out some of the big stories in national news and national politics. And let's go international now. Ginger, U.S. engaging in talks with Russia, some State Department officials involved in this. Why now? What's going on?
Been watching this very difficult situation on the border between Russia and Ukraine. The Russians have assembled their troops there on the border, and there is clearly international concern that the Russians will invade Ukraine, trying to take over this sovereign nation. We've already seen their willingness to do so in the Crimea region, and a lot of concern that this is going to happen. So we've seen President Biden push back at the Russians, giving a pretty strong threat to their President Putin. And then we saw these talks this week with the U.S. and some NATO allies in Brussels with the with the Russians. And they didn't really seem that productive. There were no promises from the Russians that they would vacate that border, that they would return their troops to their barracks, as the U.S. had said. And there's clearly some concern being raised by the Americans after these talks that they are worried that the Russians will use these meetings as a pretext to then invade Ukraine, that they'll go back and tell their people, look, we tried a diplomatic solution. It didn't work. We have no choice but to use our military. There's been a lot of, from what we understand, propaganda in Russia arguing to their people that the Ukrainians are really the one to blame for the escalation. So there has clearly been a message to the people there that they believe that military action is necessary.
What have we heard from the Biden administration and NATO allies when it comes to how they might respond if this were to happen, if Russia were to invade Ukraine, more of Ukraine, I should say.
Yeah, the U.S. and NATO have threatened some really strong sanctions against the Russians. You know, they've pretty consistently in the past sanctioned Russian and Russian oligarchs or the wealthy part of the nation that have engaged in activity that the U.S. hasn't approved. They've limited their access to the world banking system. But there was a suggestion last year that the U.S. and its NATO allies could completely cut Russia off from the world banking system. And that would be a really crippling economic sanction to impose. It's kind of the rarer sanction that we use. It's been used in very few cases and would probably have reverberating diplomatic effects if they were to do so.
So what are you watching for next on U.S.-Russian negotiations here?
I think we're going to be looking to see what these talks, how they're how they're depicted to the Russian people, and what Ukrainians are saying about this, and then further conversations between the U.S. and Russia. There have been these side channels where, for example, President Biden and President Putin spoke a few weeks ago. Do those types of conversations continue? Putin also knows that invading Ukraine is going to come with a lot of pushback on the international stage. And so he's having to weigh that, and we'll be looking to see what his relations with particularly Germany, where they sell a lot of oil, and other European nations where they have strong trading ties, what those look like.
I want to take our last couple of minutes, Ginger, to look ahead at this year's midterms. We're almost exactly 10 months off. 10 months can fly right by, but in the political world, it's a long time, too. What are you looking at right now to get a sense of where things are going in the midterms?
Yeah, I think we should be looking very closely at how Republicans or Democrats are talking about issues that affect people in their houses and their families. So inflation is a big issue. The labor market is a big issue. How they're handling shortages, how people are viewing supply chain issues. I think those are the things that affect people. And people are, if we get to November and the price of milk has still been climbing for 11 months, or the price of bread has become exorbitant, or you can't get things at the store because of supply chain issues, that's going to be a real issue for Biden. I also be watching closely how Democrats handle some of the culture war issues. You look at the Virginia governor's race. Republicans talked about education in a way that reverberated with parents and that really cost Democrats lots of votes. And I think that the biggest lesson to be learned there was that Democrats can't just write off some of these culture discussions that Republicans are having. They need to have answers. They need to be able to explain their positions. And they can't just yell, you know, oh, that's a dog whistle, and expect voters to just write off what Republicans are saying.
And in the shorter term horizon, Ginger, what story are you following this next week?
I'm going to be watching very closely to see what happens in the Senate. This voting bill is just really unlikely to pass. But if Democrats want to go back to the bill that could pass, which is the Build Back Better or a smaller version of it, it's not going to behoove them to get the last few votes they need to get across the finish line. Particularly Senator Manchin, really upset and mad at his leadership. That's not going to incentivize him to want to cooperate on other pieces of legislation. So those dynamics are going to be really important in how Schumer and Democrats handle the Senate in the next week.
Ginger, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. She was with us today for a look at some of the top stories from Washington. Coming up after the news, a scientist joins the show to share her how-to advice on at-home rapid COVID tests. And you can join in with your questions. If you're confused, I promise you're not alone. You can start now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.